Welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Hey, we got a nice, bright, warm day here in Illinois, and hopefully it's the same across the nation. We're going to continue our discussion and everything, trying to help the veterans. Again, the Progressive Radio Network under Dr. Gary Knoll and his staff are doing an incredible job of helping us. And today what we've got is set up as an incredible, a retired Army colonel, a doctor, Dr. Bart Billings. He's going to be holding a stress conference coming up here in this next week out in California. He can talk about that a little bit. Hopefully we got Ray Clark also. He's a Vietnam veteran. He wrote, again, he's been on the show and helped us a lot. He wrote the book, Never Ending War. Denise, are you there by any chance? Okay, well, Denise, Dr. Billings, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Thank you very much.
How are you today, sir?
I'm great. Sounds like you got good weather like we do.
Yeah, yes, you're not too far from my son out there in California, which is kind of nice. You're right there in the, near Oceanside and all of that.
Yeah, we're probably about 15 miles away.
Wow, that's pretty neat. Well, Ray is also with us. Ray, are you there today?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I am, and it's just an honor to be with you, Doug, and Dr. Billings, and I look forward to what you have to say.
Well, Dr. Billings, you've got an incredible distinguished career. I mean, you spent over 30 years in the military, both enlisted and officer. You did the whole thing, went all the way through, went on to medical school and got all this stuff done. I mean, wow. When do you find time to do all of this, sir?
Well, I'm glad it's behind me. I don't think I could do it now.
Well, yeah, I mean, you got a very important book that you wrote, and you sent us some information on it, From the Battlefield to the Neighborhood, Getting Back to Normal.
Yeah, the book's expected to be out in September, and I've been working with veterans, combat stress-related issues, since the mid-70s. And the combat stress conference that we started in the first Persian Gulf, I was a hospital commander and our whole hospital got deployed. That actually was the beginning of the combat stress conference because we found out people coming back were having all kind of issues, so we decided to do a conference. So now, this weekend, 22 years, longest running conference in the world on combat stress, and many consider it the gold standard.
Wow, that's something. When I looked at the program for that conference, I mean, it's astonishing. You're covering all of the aspects of it, trying to get the information out. This is designed for what, both the veteran and the practitioner?
Yes, sir. The veteran, practitioner, family members, we cover issues that is not generally covered in the military. Actually, when I retired in 2002, I had a Navy psychiatrist, chief of psychiatry, ask me if I would be interested in getting funded, since they asked me to volunteer to keep the conference going. They didn't have staff or funding, the Army. And it was a tri-service conference. It was for everybody. It was at Camp Pendleton, California.
Which is where you live.
Yeah, that's right in Oceanside, where your son lives. And but they wanted to set the agenda, and I said, no, we will continue to volunteer. We'll do it as long as people come pay tuition to pay for the facility and whatever food we give them during the conference, we'll keep it going. And when the conference stops, that means people will stop being interested, and it hasn't happened yet. And we do cover all issues. We cover things that people aren't even aware of, like this conference. We're going to have Helen Erlin. She's the founder, you know, of the Erlin Institute, and they named the Erlin Syndrome after her, and that's ectopic sensitivity, which is something that most people aren't even close to aware of. But people with traumatic brain injury benefit tremendously from the different tints that they apply to them to eliminate the light band that causes the neurological agitation from basically the sun or fluorescence. And it's amazing. So that's, you know, we talk about vibroacoustic disease that most people don't even know about, and that's high-intensity, low-frequency vibration from being in the battlefield. That causes a whole bunch of physical problems as well as psychological problems. So it's an interesting conference. We cover the traditional integrative treatment at the conference, from, you know, general counseling, the nutrition, the biofeedback, the guided imagery, the dealing with nightmares. I mean, we go through all of that. The one thing we don't focus on anymore, we talk about it, and we discovered over 22 years that they're just not effective, is the use of psychotropic medications for people both who have been on the battlefield, got them, and people who are back home and at the VA. We discovered after 22 years, well, even before that, but these medications just do not work, not for military, not for civilians. And this black box warning is disastrous. First side effect is, and black box is a serious warning. Not all medications have them. And the first side effect is suicidality.
Well, you're right at home with us. I mean, both Ray and I have been preaching against this psychotropic drugs because in our cases, you know, with PTSD and everybody we know, again, the docs at the VA want to push the drugs on you and try to get you to forget and walk away, and this creates a nightmare. And Ray can give you story upon story. He's at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, which mirrors right where you're at, and story upon story of all these problems. How and why does this happen? I mean, when we look at PTSD, we're looking at the ethical and moral dimensions. We're looking at neurophysiology, neurophysiological damage of the brain. We're looking at all of the stuff involved. How did the idea that passing a drug was somehow going to cure something that's deep in the soul?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder, we'll go back to the beginning. Post-traumatic stress, and I've been saying this to people since, like I said, the mid-70s when I was working with people at Tripler Hospital, is a normal reaction to being in an abnormal environment. 99% of the people that go into combat have post-traumatic stress. It only becomes a disorder when they can't figure out how to normalize themselves when they get back home. And normalizing yourself would require a whole bunch of things. Now, it's not, post-traumatic stress is not a neurological problem. I mean, yeah, your brain is functioning different in combat because your limbic system is all geared up, fight or flight. And when you get back home, you need to figure out how to return your nervous system to being in the neighborhood. That's what the book is about. And there's a multitude of ways of doing it, which are all integrative treatment, integrative wellness ways. The psychiatric medication just complicates the effects of integrative treatment, and they actually cause brain cell damage. They distort brain cells, and they actually kill some brain cells. So it's much more difficult to get back to normal if you're on psychiatric meds. They just don't work, and the side effects, every mass shooter in the country, if you look closely, you'll find they were on some type of psychiatric medications. And even the people who committed murders on abroad were on psychiatric medications. The shooting at the clinic in Baghdad, the guy was on antidepressants. And again, the black box warnings are hard to get on medications. And the FDA put them on most of these psychiatric medications, just about all the psychiatric meds. And they're disastrous. Now, one of the speakers at our conference is going to be talking about dead in bed. He's a neurologist. His name is Fred Bauman. He's an expert in this area, and he's researched. He's semi-retired, pretty much retired, but he writes a lot, and he has time for research. And he's found approximately 400 veterans whose deaths he would contribute, well, he would attribute to psychiatric medication cocktails. And some of them is very clear. The coroner would basically do the autopsy and say died from adverse reaction of psychiatric med cocktails. I mean, there, back in Charlotte, there were three, the Charlotte Gazette published an article years ago where three veterans, they were on active duty, they were in their early 20s, all on the same psychiatric cocktail, died in their sleep. So Bauman's going to be talking at the conference about dead in bed syndrome.
That's amazing.
Well, I think, you know, we've all had the problems. We've been there and done that. Somehow, you know, we got by it. But when you got the psychotropic drugs and all this stuff going on, and the person's trying to alleviate the pain, then he starts into the booze and into the street drugs, and then he totally misuses his prescribed meds, and then you add on psychotropic meds. You got to wonder, you know, what happened to common sense? Because, I mean, the vet is looking for a way out. He can't alleviate the pain. So he jumps into all these ways to do it, and then the meds that they are given just create a nightmare.
Well, they cloud your judgment. And a lot of times people taking these medications have no awareness of how inappropriate they are. And, they have a masking effect. So the people around them say, well, you're really acting weird, but they don't realize it. And they start contemplating suicide and anger and hostility. But their judgment and reasoning is shot, and they're doing some really weird things. Probably the best book that I ever read that talks about the adverse effects of these medications is Medication Madness. That book was written by Peter Breggin. And coincidentally, he's a psychiatrist, and he doesn't use psychiatric meds, but 95% of them do, and I discovered... Hello?
Hello. Doug?
Yeah.
Okay. We might have lost Dr. Billings. I'm not sure.
Did he drop? He dropped off?
I'm not sure.
Are you there, Ray?
Oh, he's coming back. Yes, sir.
Hey.
But I wanted to say that when I wrote this book, I put a chapter in there called Coping Skills. Now, I didn't eliminate the VA from that because they are professionals, and they are trying to help, and they're trying to give medication in the right dosages, but
Hello?
There's a lot of abuse there.
Hello?
Yeah, welcome back.
Okay.
Yeah, I got disconnected.
Yeah, Ray was just... Go ahead, Ray. Explain what you were talking about.
Okay, I've written in my book, and this is a first-hand account, Dr. Billings. I am a patient. I was in a lot of combat in Vietnam. I've written a book, and it's called The Never-Ending War because it never seems to end. But I wrote a chapter called Coping Skills, and in that I did put things like, you know, the VA is trying to help you. But most of it is stuff you have to do yourself. One of the things Doug and I have talked about before is I use a Vicks nasal inhaler or another type. It doesn't matter. But the nasal inhaler is made of menthol, and one thing it does is startles you when you use it and when you're having a panic attack. You breathe on this thing, and the other thing it does, it opens up your sinuses and nasal paths just so you get a little shot of oxygen to your brain. And it's not a silver bullet, but it will help to neutralize the effects of post-traumatic stress, the anxiety attack or the panic attack. But there's a lot of things that you can do. We tell them how to isolate if you're going to isolate. You don't isolate with drugs, alcohol, pornography, or weapons. But there are some do's that you can take with you, like take non-decaf beverages, take water, take food, read positive literature, try to get calmed down, listen to some soft music and not crazy music. Because you have to refocus yourself. You have to get past this panic feeling, and then you have to come down. And medications will just keep you in la-la land for so long that you're apt to do anything when you're like that. You can't drive normal. You can't operate machinery normal. You can't do even carry on a decent conversation because people know that you're on some type of drug. And so it just hinders everybody. Most
well,
of
you know the pilot who flew the plane into the Alps?
Yes, sir.
He was on psychiatric meds.
Well,
and
yeah.
In the medication, the warnings, the black box warnings, do not operate heavy equipment. He was flying an airplane. And he was on psychiatric meds.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really get publicized because psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry generate every year $333 billion selling these drugs.
Wow.
So, you know, and what you're talking about in your book is integrative treatment, integrative wellness. See, psychiatry, when they started, and they started, you know, giving these drugs out to people in combat, that never happened before in the history of the military. And these drugs, I was told by many people that they figured about 90% of our troops in combat at one time or other were given psychiatric drugs.
Wow.
And it's kind of like the Marine sergeant who called into headquarters saying, "Send me, please send me some equipment. We can't sleep at night in Afghanistan. It gets really cold, and we need something to help us sleep, you know, and so send us some equipment." Well, he was anticipating getting some blankets and tents and things like that, warm weather clothing. He got boxes of Seroquel to help him sleep. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, stop and think about that. That's an antipsychotic they sent him.
Yeah.
So they were giving our soldiers Seroquel like they're handing out, you know, cough drops.
Right.
There was a whole battalion that flew back to Germany, and I talked to the battalion commander, and he said that a medic would walk down the aisle of the airplane and gave every single soldier a Seroquel pill to help him sleep.
Wow.
This is absolutely ridiculous. I know when I was a mobilization officer at 330th Medical Brigade at one point when we were putting this all together, and this is deploying for a Desert Storm, and when we put all this together, we didn't have any of these meds or anything even thought about. I know in the command staff, we didn't even consider it. You know, we have the 55th CSC, and the guys up there in northern Wisconsin, you know, that all got wiped out down in Texas, but, you know, they weren't considering all these type of things and using it this time, just kind of figure out, like you said, this integrative management discussion and, you know, working through it.
Yeah, they use critical incident stress management debriefing techniques, which were very effective since the 80s. Dr. Mitchell developed this. He was a fireman, and the Red Cross and the military and everybody was using it. But in the mid-90s, the chief psychiatrist for the Army was saying, well, we need to medicate these people. And right around 2002 or 3 or 4, she got her way, and they started medicating on the battlefield. Soldiers are going into combat with 180 days worth of psychiatric medications that they were sharing and passing around. And the problem is they trust the people giving them to them.
Yeah.
And these, it's kind of like, well, the doctor told me to take this. And they started realizing, you know, so-and-so is like a zombie. I remember one Marine I was working with, he went into the medical tent saying, do you have anything to help me stop smoking? I need to stop smoking. And they gave him an antidepressant. Well, he got back to Pendleton, the hospital, and he says, I'm having all kind of weird problems. And do you think it's the drug that they gave me that I'm still taking? And they said, there's nothing in your medical records that shows they gave you any drug. And here, you know, here it is. He said, here's the bottle, Wellbutrin. So, you know, it's integrative. What you say in your book is true. Integrative treatment is the treatment of choice, whether it's going for a walk, whether it's biofeedback, whether it's nutrition, whether it's guided imagery, whether it's yoga. All of these things are tailored. You can tailor an individual program, an individual wellness program, IWP, for a vet, depending on what his needs are. If he's having nightmares, you're going to put him together with somebody who deals with nightmares and therapy. And if he's overweight, you're going to put him together with some nutritional stuff and an exercise program. And it needs to be tailored to the individual. We had a guy that came to our combat stress conference one year. He had a lesion in his foot, and the VA was going to amputate his foot. He was depressed. He was a lieutenant colonel. He was ready to commit suicide. He was on psychiatric meds. He lost his family, his house. The guy was in bad shape, and now they're going to cut his foot off. And he spent 5 days at the conference, and I had him meet, and he was having nightmares. I had him meet with all of our experts who win from all over the world. They speak. I mean, we have speakers that come in from Germany last year, Denmark. I had him meet with everybody for the 5 days. He left there with new hope. He came in a wheelchair with a big bandage. We even had a magnetic healing device there that somebody was presenting that heals tissue quicker. So he left that conference, walked out with a small Band-Aid. He met with everybody. He had referrals. He knew exactly where he was going. His whole life changed in 5 days.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And he did not need his foot amputated. We had the physiatrist. Most people don't even know what a physiatrist is, and that's a crime because that specialty was born from the First World War. That's a physical medicine and rehab doctor, physician. And the physiatrist said, no, you need hyperbaric chambers, and gave him a treatment program. and his whole life changed in 5 days.
I know we had a crisis here because, and Ray and I have dealt with this in restless. One of our co-hosts for this show just committed suicide here about a month ago after he lost all hope. He'd gone for the VA for hope, and he couldn't get it, couldn't get the medical care. And the physiological ailments bothering him and his children and his wife overwhelmed him as they got turned away and turned away. And then the PTSD factor and the drugs took him apart.
I wish he could have come to our conference. Wish he could have come to our conference. It's kind of like the Chris Kyle situation. I was on a radio show in Texas before he was killed, and the host of the radio show asked me straightforward, don't you think it's discriminatory to deprive our veterans from the ability to purchase a firearm if they had been diagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder? And, you know, I collect, you don't know this, but I do collect some antique firearms, and I'm a believer in the Second Amendment. And he was expecting me to agree with him, and I says, they should not. Anybody who has a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, there is a psychiatrist somewhere in the background who is prescribing or having someone prescribe psychiatric meds. And they are mind-altering drugs. You do not want anybody with a firearm on these medications. That is not therapy to go and shoot when you're on these meds because you don't know what you're doing. And sure enough, I mean, I wish Kyle was listening to the program because I feel very strongly that the VA not only let down the shooter because he was on all kind of psychiatric meds as well as illegal meds, but even worse, Kyle was at the VA in these groups, and the staff at the VA knew he was taking people to the range. If I was running that group, I'd have said, Chris, take him play golf, take him play tennis. Take him to the range. They didn't tell him. I feel very strongly that Kyle's family has justification for a lawsuit by not informing of this, as well as the family of the shooter, by not doing anything to help this guy through his rehabilitation. So that was just tragic on both sides.
You know,
It wasn't brought up in the trial, which upsets me. All they said is, oh, he wasn't mentally ill. The defense tried to say, well, he's mentally ill. Well, he wasn't mentally ill. He was having adverse reactions to all of these drugs, which is different from being mentally ill.
Doug, glad to hear somebody say all of this.
Let me interject one thing in that. When I in my book, I tried to give realistic things that I use in my own life because I've had all the problems of post-traumatic stress for many years. I didn't know what it was for many years, and I didn't go to the VA until 32 years after I came back home. But I'd been suffering all those times. But just like not being able to go to sleep or bad dreams, I tried to get the veteran to look at his life and see what you're looking at or listening to or reading before you go to sleep. You have to do certain things and quit doing certain things because whatever you're thinking about when you do go to sleep, you may possibly dream in that same direction of things. So you have to be careful what you're putting in your eyes. It's called the eye gate. And, try to get them to not drink, like, caffeine before. Try to get them not to take pain pills before you go to sleep because it will hinder your sleep. So there's a lot of things you can do to help, be able to sleep. I know there's some things you can't understand and you can't control, but you can control a lot of things if you'll try. And it doesn't have anything to do with the medications either.
That's appropriate for anybody who has trouble sleeping. You don't have to be a vet. My wife has trouble sleeping. It's just kind of, difficulty. Maybe it's a physiological thing, but you have to do certain things, and the things you're talking about are very effective. Now, nightmares, violent nightmares, now that's a different story. And that's part of post-traumatic stress. That is not a disorder. It's part of post-traumatic stress, which is a normal reaction to being in combat. Now, if you're not dealing with it and figuring out a way how to eliminate that, it starts interfering with your life, and now it does become a disorder. But the Navajo Indians, hundreds of years ago, had a cure for violent nightmares. I mean, a real simple, easy cure. And basically what they had the people do, the shaman for the tribe would take, whether it was a little boy or whether it was one of their warriors, and say, okay, I want you, when you have the nightmare of running off a cliff and falling in the rocks below to your death, I want you to go back and I want you to redream that. I want you to focus on dreaming running off the cliff. But when you run off the cliff, this giant eagle flies underneath you and you wind up on its back and it takes you for a ride through the whole country and you're looking at the rivers and you're looking at the mountains and the eagle takes you back to your lodge and you step off its wing and you say, thank you, eagle. And, you know, something as simple as that works.
Right.
To redream it with a positive ending.
Right.
And practice
that. Well, I can
that.
Tell you this, that when I came back for 10 years, I had the reoccurring dream when my platoon got wiped out. And now
right.
I will tell you this, I would lay there and I would try to redo it in my mind and try to go back to sleep. But I was still, in those years, I was doing a lot of drugs and alcohol. So
mm-hmm.
it was altering my conscience and everything else I was doing. So, but if you're trying to get away from those type of negative stimulants, it would help you. I mean, I could understand exactly what you're saying. You were talking about suicide and people committing suicide. They estimate, and you may have a greater knowledge of this, but I have read articles where they were talking about Vietnam veterans have a suicide rate that is upwards of close to 250,000 since Vietnam. There is a Vietnam memorial that everybody talks about and goes to and sees, but there's also a wall that's called suicide.com. And it's got a lot of veterans on that wall that committed suicide without really trying that much. They were on drugs. They were on things. But it's so easy to slip over the edge when you don't mean to, when you're doing that kind of thing. So
they did a show. Well, right now, what they're saying for the past few years, 22 veterans from all wars are committing suicide every day.
Right.
And I've been told by people that it's more because some states don't report suicides by vets. Now, the incidence of suicides in the military has increased dramatically with the increase of psychiatric medications. From 2005 to 2011, the Department of Defense purchased 700% more psychiatric meds than they did before, 700% increase.
Wow.
So there was a parallel. I had Congress hold hearings. I convinced them to hold hearings to look at the relationship between suicide and psychiatric medications in the military. That hearing was February 24, 2010. And we showed the relationship. So there's a direct correlation with the suicides. When you have the people at the VA, I interviewed a VA psychiatrist. He was a chief psychiatrist, and he told me he medicated 98% of the patients he sees. The only, you know, it's starting to turn in terms of what the public is starting to do. Back in Scranton, Pennsylvania, there was a lawsuit by a Marine veteran. The guy was a real hero. He was a tremendous Marine. His name was Stanley Laskowski, Laskowski. He sued the VA about 3 years, 2.5 years ago because standard of care. He was being given so many medications, he didn't know what he was doing. I think he even went into pharmacy and stole things. I mean, he was just totally out of character for the hero that he was. He sued the VA and won $3.7 million for inappropriate care. Now, that's unusual that you can get it for, you know, standard of care for mental health issues. The VA has awarded, and this is in the book, you know, I did some research on this, they've awarded, probably over the past 10 years, $700 million of malpractice. That's a lot of money that you and I are paying for inappropriate, you know, amputate a leg when it didn't need to be amputated, like the Lieutenant Colonel I talked about. So now they're starting to become more aware, to people and the attorneys, that there's malpractice. There's sudden deaths because of malpractice and misprescribing. Well, prescribing medication instead of integrative treatment. There's suicides. So more and more, I just did expert witness work for a guy in Arizona, an airman. And that was a sad, sad case. He come out of the Air Force with a master's degree. He flew secured missions on aircraft for jamming and electronic warfare. He spoke two languages, which are hard languages. He spoke Hebrew and Korean. He came out, he enrolled in a doctorate program to get his doctorate. He was teaching at two community colleges. He went to the VA, and he had GI problems, which is a symptom of high-intensity, low-frequency vibration, which he spent thousands of hours in on the airplane. That's just one of the problems that you get. It's vibroacoustic disease. They misdiagnosed it as post-traumatic stress disorder. They started medicating him. Almost immediately, he developed Parkinsonian tremor, which they attributed to post-traumatic stress disorder, not the medication they were giving him. He spent 15 years at the VA on all types of psychiatric meds, lost everything, lost the schooling, lost the job, lost everything. In 8 of those years, he was in a wheelchair. He couldn't even walk because he was so medicated. And finally, on his own, he left the VA and spent $30,000+ of his own money and enrolled in a detox program. 19 days later, he went into the detox program in a wheelchair. 19 days later, he walked out. He had a slight Parkinsonian tremor in his arm, and within a year, that would disappear as well. And he filed suit against the VA for destroying his life for 15 years, which I could understand. I was a witness. All they had to do was send this guy to a GI specialist, and his life would have continued. But no, they decided he had post-traumatic stress, and they started medications.
Well, one thing that we've run into, and we've seen this over and over again, whether it's an Army or military medical conference, civilian medical conference, is the doctors aren't talking to each other. So you got somebody that's an internal medicine specialist, you got somebody's respiratory, somebody's orthopedic or neuro, and they're not talking to the guy that's the psychologist, psychiatrist. They're operating almost in a vacuum rather than looking at a holistic approach and how do we deal with all of these problems.
See, here's the problem. Now, I worked at the medical school at UC Davis, and that was a problem there, too. Patients were seeing by different doctors and given one physical after another that replicated the one they had the week before. And I was a patient service coordinator for a while besides running. I ran physical medicine rehabilitation at the medical school, the teaching hospital. And as a patient service coordinator, I would meet with patients saying, oh, these doctors, he's giving me this, he's giving me that. So I would say, okay, we're going to find one doctor, and you're not going to talk to anybody else except one doctor, and he's responsible for your care. Well, that happens all over the place, and that's what you have to insist on. I want one doctor to communicate with all the other doctors to take care of me and put it all together. That doctor in the military should be not a psychiatrist. It should be a physiatrist. A physical medicine, a rehabilitation doctor. Now, let me give you a little history on that. In 1920, the Smith-Fess Act was put together because a lot of our veterans were wandering around with all kinds of disabilities, and they wanted to provide, it's called the Vocational Rehabilitation Act, vocational rehab services. And they did, and that's when PM&R started, physical medicine rehabilitation. You work with amputations, you work with brain damage, you work with muscle diseases. You work with all of the problems that veterans have. In 1937, the specialty that came out of physical medicine rehabilitation was physiatry. Now, physiatry, PM&R, they were born of war. These specialties were born of war. Here's the crime today. The VA system across the United States hires somewhere around 800 psychiatrists. They only have 40 physiatrists.
Wow.
It should be the opposite. And physiatry really should step up and do what it should be doing instead of allowing this to occur. And I've talked to physiatrists, and I'm saying, you're not doing your job. You're letting our veterans down. You were born of war, and you are the treatment specialist that run the whole team that does all the integrative stuff, and you're not giving them psychiatric meds. So that's a little history on who should be treating our vets. It shouldn't be psychiatry. They belong nowhere near our veterans with the medications.
I had a problem with the VA psychiatrist, and my doc primary care said, let's go there and get the help. So we had the documentation. We took it in there, and they promptly lost everything because they didn't want to deal with the reality of the incredible toxic exposures, the known health effects, and all this stuff, and the consequences thereof. And it was kind of like, oh, we don't want to know about this, and so we'll get rid of it. It's just like...
Well, let me go back to the medical school. Psychiatry did not even want to come near our department. They didn't know how to deal with muscle diseases, burns, amputations. We had to have our own psychosocial vocational section where we had rehabilitation psychologists and social workers that knew about all the medical problems, that were trained and had medical aspects in all these areas. Psychiatry doesn't know about this. They don't want to, and if they don't know about it and they're unskilled in it, sure they're going to lose the papers because it makes them look like what they aren't. They're not qualified to deal with you.
Dr. Billy, let me ask a question, too, because Doug and I have talked about this before. But I know Camp Lejeune, Cherry Point, Marine bases. I work at those places with Marines and sailors dealing with post-traumatic stress. But about half of them have never been gone overseas, and they're entering the military now with signs of post-traumatic stress. And what has been brought out is that they have lived with, their grandparents were Vietnam veterans, their parents were the Gulf War veterans, and now they're coming in. But they have been living through so much divorce and remarriage and all these dysfunctional things of the families that they've come to combat, but it wasn't across the ocean. It was in their own homes. And so they're coming through all that, joining the military as a family that they never had, and now they're showing signs, aggravation, fear, tension, anxiety, all of it, depression. And so they're having to treat those folks, too. And, they say, well, what's wrong with you? You have never been overseas. You've never been in combat. Well, they have been in combat. It was a different form of it. It was molestation. It was a lot of things there. And these poor kids are killing themselves at the rate of the same ones that are going overseas.
No more.
So, how do you
feel? There are more suicides of soldiers who never were deployed than there were soldiers who were deployed. Did you know that?
Really? No, I didn't.
Yeah, there are more. And yes, come from where they came from, I could understand, people coming in that had some issues to start with. But stop and think about this. I'll use myself as an example. When I was 18, 19, I was coming just through an intersection when the car in front of me was T-boned, and the elderly couple inside were ejected through the windows. I got out of the car to help them, and they had no faces. They were dead. And I tried, and I realized that. So by the time the ambulance got there, I said, they're gone. And I thought about that. And to this day, when I'm back in Pennsylvania, I drive by that corner, I think about it. Now, do you want to call that post-traumatic stress? Well, sure it is. But did it interfere with my life? No. I was going to school. I had a nice family. I was meeting all of my psychological needs in a healthy way. And I thought about it. I might have had some dreams about it, but they went away. But still to this day, and now we're talking 1964, 5, to this day, if I'm back there, driving back there, I think about those people and I see their faces. Yes, it's a normal reaction to being in an abnormal environment. We got to understand that. Now, to talk about the suicides and from people that don't go to combat, when I got my master's, they says, okay, you're going, you can't go for your doctorate. We're going to send you to the military, the Army. I got my 1A and everything else. And So I wound up at Fort Leonard Wood as being trained as a combat engineer. That was where I experienced post-traumatic stress. I'm laying, and you know, our family, not much. My father was a coal miner, but we, you know, we worked and we made our way. But here I'm in a barracks with a whole bunch of people that I don't know, showering with 30 people at a time in a tin shower room. You know, toilets lined up on one wall, sinks on the other in the morning. And this was a total change, and it was stressful. Plus, at that time, it was go to the Army or go to jail, so we were getting a lot of hoods from Chicago. And these people were bad people. We were losing on that post through murders, people being killed for the money in their pocket, their M14 to sell for drugs. They were averaging, you know, several murders a month. And we had riots, race riots. I remember because I had 2 years ROTC, I was an acting sergeant, platoon sergeant, and I told all my platoon, I said, tonight when you go to bed, I think there's going to be some action outside. Everybody sleep with your entrenching tool. Now, people couldn't wait to leave there to go to Vietnam so they'd have live ammunition. You know, when I posted guards in the Jeep, I posted them. I told them to hide in the bushes because, you know, they only gave billy clubs because they were afraid they'd be killed for their empty M16. They didn't issue bullets when they were on guard duty in the middle of nowhere. So that was a lot of post-traumatic stress, and a lot of guys couldn't handle it. So they weren't in combat, but their whole life, again, what do I diagnose? What do I call post-traumatic stress? When you are in an abnormal environment. This environment, this military environment, is not a normal environment for everybody that gets drafted in the military, and we got to be aware of that. So when you say, well, how could this guy have post-traumatic stress? He hasn't been deployed. He has post-traumatic stress because his total life has changed. Right. And you saw Full Metal Jacket. You saw that movie, right?
Right.
Okay, what did the trainee do? The trainee committed suicide. He blew his head off with his rifle. He couldn't deal with it. So that's when you have to be aware of it. That's when the military has to be aware of it. You know, these people are in a totally different environment, and they're going to experience post-traumatic stress. And if they don't, it's abnormal because they haven't been here before. And it's not a normal environment when you're teaching people every day how to kill people. I mean,
the whole ethical dilemma, I mean, you know that it's wrong and everything else, and yet it's the hoorah and the John Wayne Rambo stuff that you're going to do it, and I don't know how anybody can come out of that and not be altered or changed.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So when you say a lot of people commit suicide who haven't been deployed, well, see, they're not looking at the stressors of just being trained to kill.
Right. Well, I suppose my thought was, and some of the people I've worked with, they grew up in dysfunctional homes from divorce, and I think the divorce rate of Vietnam veterans is over 90%, and the Gulf War guys are like 90%, and now today it's about the same rate or going that way. And what it is, these kids have been raised in dysfunctional homes, so every day when they get home from school, there's some guy there that's not their dad, but he's throwing stuff and cussing and drinking and doing dope and watching pornography through the television all the time. And these kids have been raised in a fearful life, not all of them, but some of them. And that's the ones I was thinking more of. It's like being in a car wreck once a week over a period of time. And so it would be, you know, post-trauma, but it would be a lot of post-trauma.
No, of course. The children of vets. My father fought in World War II. You know, and he really didn't talk much about it. He came back, he went to work, and moved on with his life. I didn't hear him talk much about it at all. I don't believe, you know, anything he did had anything to do with the experience, but it was a normal reaction to being there. So, you know, he dealt with it by meeting his psychological needs. You know, we have, all of us human beings have higher psychological needs And they are need for love and belonging, need for power, self-worth, need for fun and enjoyment, and a need to be free. These are higher psychological needs. And if we address this with these youngsters and see that they are meeting their psychological needs in a healthy way, not meeting their need for love and belonging by joining a gang, maybe by joining the Boy Scouts or joining a church group or being an athlete. But we have to address how can we help these kids meet their needs and how can we help their parent who's having these problems, who hasn't normalized himself, meet their needs in a more appropriate way besides self-medication or using psychiatric meds. So we have to address an individual's needs and how they're being met. And they're going to meet them one way or another, whether it's a healthy way or a non-healthy way.
That's right.
They're going to meet them.
Self-medicating.
And if their pain is so intense, the psychological pain by not meeting them, they can anesthetize themselves by using drugs, whether they're legal or illegal.
You know, I think it's so difficult because today when we look at it and we keep hearing about it, all these people have gone in the military and they're coming out because of the changes. They've gone, the people that have enlisted predominant, and you look at the demographic data, don't have adequate education. Like Ray said, they came from broken homes and everything else. They've gone to the military. They've had this totally abnormal situation they've had to deal with that they don't have the coping skills at all to deal with.
Right.
Then they come out, and somehow they're going to be reintegrated into society and pick up and start running off and, you know, a normal life. For some of us, we were lucky. We, you know, got out and we came back and we got our education. We moved on our life, but it still affected us. But this abandonment that I'm sensing and I'm picking up because of the group of people we're dealing with is frightening because it's,
let me address that. Let me tell you a story about that. When I was writing the book, I interviewed a veteran from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Strategic Air Command. He flew in all of those places. He was 94. And I said to him, and I don't know if you know this, but the Army Air Corps lost more people in battle than the Marines or Navy.
You're right. I agree. I mean, I've heard
tremendous losses. I mean, and so I said to him, I said, Frank, how did you handle combat stress at your time? You know, the Greatest Generation, what did you do? Because you've lived a successful life. And he said, well, Doc, he said, on our first mission, all of my crew were atheists. He said, when we landed, they were all Christians. Now, so in other words, they did a lot of praying together. He said there were even Jewish guys that were saying Hail Marys. So after his 33 missions, and he survived 33 missions, they sent him back to South Carolina. Because 33 missions, you're still alive. That's incredible. After, you know, all the losses. So you're done. You did your duty, 33 missions. They sent him to South Carolina. I said, okay, when you went back to South Carolina, how long were you there? I was there 3 months. My whole crew, everybody's there 3 months to kind of get back to, you know, being a civilian. And I said, so what was instrumental for those 3 months? Did they give you drugs? No, they didn't give us any drugs. What worked for you? He said the Catholic priest was there. And we talked to him, and we talked, and we talked, and we got over it. Getting back to normal. Now, they were there 3 months. Now, Frank was unfortunate enough that they said, we need you to go to Europe again, go to England. You're going to fly B-17s now. You flew B-25s, and he flew another 11 missions before they realized, hey, you got 44 missions. I mean, you've done more than your share. Now, what happened? They were 3 months getting back to normal.
Right.
What happens to our vets now? They come back. You stop and think about this. How long my training to be a combat engineer was 6-7 months. And, you know, I could blow anything up and disarm mines and all that stuff. 6-7 months. It took them to train me. How long do our troops get now to be trained to coming back to the neighborhood, getting back to normal? 24 hours.
I know in my own case, in fact, going back to Vietnam and then Desert Storm in Vietnam, I had my last combat mission in a B-52, and 24 hours later, I was sitting in a VFW drinking beer with my uncles and everybody I knew and my dad, and it was like there was no real, you know, time for reintegration. It's kind of like you come from combat and you do it, and then in Desert Storm, we finished cleaning up the friendly fire, and I went to Gus Pagonis, and I said, hey, boss, they're all ready to come back, and he said, okay, get on an airplane and come home. You know, 24 hours later, I'm sitting back here.
Well, see, that didn't happen in World War II. And that's why these guys didn't have the kinds of problems. That's why my father didn't have the kinds of problems. They were on boats for weeks. They were talking about, hey, I have nightmares. You know what I do to nightmares? I remember one of the vets saying to me, oh, yeah, we were talking about it. We had nightmares of Iwo Jima, and it was terrible, and many people were killed, and we couldn't sleep. And one of the guys on the boat said, I dream about Betty Grable and nightmares go away. So they said, really, that works, huh? And they figured it out. That's called reciprocal inhibition. You can't have two emotions going on at the same time. And they figured it out, but they had the time together to work it out. Like Frank and his crew, they were in South Carolina for 3 months. And see, that's what we need now. If we're taking 6 months to train people how to be warriors, we need to take at least a month to train them how to get back to the neighborhood, how to be civilians again, and that's not happening.
The kids don't have those skills to deal with it normally, the reason they went in the military to begin with, and then it's all fouled up, and they come back, and now they're so far in the hole, it's how do you get out? There's no ladder high enough.
That's right. You're exactly right. And the military is letting our troops down by not setting up a program. Maybe half the time it took them to train them to be warriors, you know, take that time, everybody being discharged. Now, they have a program in San Diego, and I think it's the best in the country. It's called a reboot program. A month before you're discharged from the military, you spend 3 weeks going through this program, civilian program run by former military people. And what they have is the first couple weeks, they're training them about psychological needs and, you know, how to get back to normal, how to get back to neighborhood. And then they have an intensive week on how to fill out job applications and how to do resumes and all that stuff. They did a follow-up study on that program, the university here. And the people, and I was a keynote speaker, and I was impressed. They had about 40 people graduate every 3 weeks. And they were talking about what their plans were. I'm planning on going to college. I'm going to be a veterinarian. I'm planning to go work in my father's company. This college did a follow-up. 95% of them, years later, were doing what they said they were going to do when they left reboot.
I know when I got back from Vietnam and got out, I mean, I got out on a Tuesday, and 3 days later I started my undergraduate degree at Western and went on from there. But I had a plan when I was over in Vietnam as I was coming back. I'm going back to school, and this is what I'm going to do. And that all came about, and then it just kept growing and growing and growing. But when these kids don't have the academic preparation, they don't have the family structure in place, I mean, how can they even determine or identify what path they want to go on in the future? Because there's nothing there to build on.
You're right, and that's why the reboot program works. And it's only 3 weeks. But it's effective.
Well, myself and three other veteran, combat veterans, one of them is Johnny Brunda. He's been on Doug's show before. And they have developed an organization called the Joint Veterans Crisis Response Team. And we put out a brochure, Dr. Billings, of how we got through post-traumatic stress. And we had severe post-traumatic stress. If you ever read my book, and I hope to get you one of them, you'll see where I was through a lot of combat up on the DMZ of Vietnam. And when I came back home, I didn't go into college. I went into the bottle. I went in just a lot of problems, a lot of things. And it really detoured my my life. But what we try to do is get these guys some information of how to more or less reboot their life. You get a goal. You have to focus on it. You have to move forward. You draw a line in the sand.
Google the reboot program. I think it's the best in the country.
Yeah. Well, you get them to draw a line in the sand between yesterday and today, and you focus on the rest of your life. Let it be the first day of the rest of your life. Don't allow your past to determine your future.
Right.
They say if you forget your past, you're destined to repeat it. But if you dwell on your past, it will rob your future, and which is true.
And that's called reality. That's called reality therapy.
Okay, and so we're getting the message.
That's choice theory psychology, William Glasser.
Make a conscious decision to not let your past determine your future. And
exactly.
I wish somebody had told me that many years ago. I wish I could have gone further. And my, you know, when you start getting married like that and you start having children, then your future is pretty much wrapped up.
Yeah.
That's what you're going to be doing, working three jobs and trying to support your family. But what they're talking a lot about now, they haven't talked about it a whole lot in the past where I've been, but it was called moral injury. Of where
a
young American overseas to a third world country, he has to fight or whatever. Just being in the country is different. And then when you come back to Disney World, where we live, you are seeing in black and white where everybody is seeing in color. Someone said one time that when a combat veteran watches a movie, he always laughs and cries in the wrong places. And so they're emotionally changed. And so what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to get him and to reason himself and make a conscious decision that I'm not going to let this destroy me, or I'm not going to let people destroy me. Whatever's happened in the past is back there. We do try to get them. One of the things I tell them is the best home improvement you can do is take your family to church. Well, why?
Because we're out of time here. Dr. Billings, can you come back and join us again, sir?
Sure.
Okay, great, Ray. Thank you very much, and thank everybody for joining us today. Dr. Billings, best wishes on your up conference, and you keep us informed. Let Gary know how it works out, and we can get the information out to help people. Thank you, and God bless America.
Thank you.